Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Moran from the County Archives and I'm Jack Coleman, are at the home of Michael Assel in Perkinsfield this afternoon, and this is May the 2nd, 1974. This is the second trip to talk to Mike. We were here on February the 20th, and we're back again to learn something of his social history. I'm not going to enlarge on that, except to say to Mike, we would like you to speak on what life was like before 1900, and tell us what life was like to you as far back as you can remember. So let you start, Mike, and tell us that. And periodically, Peter and I will break in here to ask you about certain things we would like to know.
Well, starting my life as a child, of course, people were very poor then. And all I can remember of my early childhood is that I was a very unhealthy child. And my earliest recollection of anything that I've seen that more or less excited me was, I was in my mother's arms and I was in the church, and she took me to the window, and all the men in Perkinsfield had guns on their shoulders with red coats, and I don't suppose I was more than 2.5 years old then. That was the first thing that I can remember that gave me some excitement. Now, being a sickly child, I never started school till the 1st of May after I was 7 years old. And I had to have my father take me there because I'd never been out anywhere outside of pretty well near my home. And my mother used to bake in a wooden box with the what kind of mustard was it? Keen's mustard. And I started learning my letters on that box. And then Mother bought me a small book. And by the time I went to school, I knew my letters and I could read quite well. And so when I went to school, it was a man by the name of Archambault from Montreal. And he put me in the baby class, and after he had the lesson, or he said, "You're not going to stay in the baby class. As you know your letters, you can read." So he put me in part two of the first book.
Excuse me, sir, where was the school located?
The school was 1 mile south of Perkinsfield. And I lived a mile south of that, a mile and a quarter south.
And you walked back and forth every day to school when you started to go by yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that we had no underwear in wintertime then. Mother used to put flannelette, double our pants with flannelette, short pants, and long woolen stockings, of course.
Did your mother make all your clothes then?
Oh, yes. I can tell you a story. When I was 13 years old, she had made me a suit to make my first communion when I was 11. And, of course, she had made me a vest. Why she had made me a vest, I don't know. But however, she made me a vest. And then at 13, I was going to be confirmed in LaFontaine. And we lived at Cahuadra Beach here, and I'd walk night and morning to LaFontaine and back for catechism for a week or two, I forget which. But anyway, a certain day, the boys were inside the church, and we were coming out, and I was in the front with another boy, and the girls were waiting on the sidewalk. And we stood there, and one of the girls, and I knew who she was because she used to come to her uncle here, and she was a Beaupré, and she said to her companion, she said, "Look at that little boy from Perkinsfield, his vest is too short." And by God, I looked down, you know, my shirt showed. Geez, I could have gone through the floor, you know. However, these are things that you remember for a long time.
Well, you just carry on.
Yes,
right?
Well, when I went to school, you were talking a while ago there of getting 5 cents to about the furnace or the stove. We used to walk the mile to come and get the teacher's soup. He boarded at Baudouin's store here in the village. We used to walk a mile, and we'd be fighting to have that privilege so that we'd get a 1 cent stick of marshmallow, you know. That was our pay to come and get his soup. I first went to, of course, it was a bilingual school, but there were perhaps 50 pupils, only one teacher, and there wasn't much English taught, although I did get to know a little bit about English. We also had a neighbor by the name of Nightingale where we lived, and occasionally he would come over, or I'd be in the field with my father and him, and this perhaps gave me a little bit of knowledge of English. But then, when I was just before I reached the age of 12 in January, we moved north here of this of the church, and I had to go to school in Lafave's Corners. Well, in that school, they were mostly all English, and they had an English teacher, young Bill, all his Irishmen in Phelpston there, you know, Bill Coughlin was the teacher. And I was lost, completely lost. He didn't teach like the old French-Canadian teacher, and I had trouble with English. So I only went to school for about a month and a half, and I quit. So I quit school shortly after I was 12 years old. And by the way, this Bill Coughlin became a famous surgeon in Chicago later. He went to Chicago and he became a famous surgeon. Then...
While you were going to school up until the time you were 12, did you help your father at all around the farm? Did you do any...
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember one fall when I was 10, he kept me from school 3 weeks to pick roots. He was breaking up a piece of land, and he'd start a fire, and I'd be picking the roots and piling them on the fire. He'd have 3 or 4 fires going, and I would work all day picking
Were other children kept out as needed too?
Oh, yes, a lot of children were kept from school. Yes.
That was a common thing then? Work had to be done?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when potato digging time came, everybody went at the potatoes, you know. Well, that kept on until they started buying machinery. I know you can talk to anybody of my age, and even in the 40s, they've picked potatoes too.
Well, then you say you stopped school at about 12 and a half, and then what?
It was a month and a half after I was 12, yes.
What did you do then?
Well, I started cutting, working in the bush with my father when I quit school. He bought me a small axe, and I went and helped him in the bush. I wasn't much with the axe, but I was good on the crosscut saw. And from the time I quit until spring, we cut 84 cords of firewood, 22 inches long.
Hardwood.
And piled it up on the sand hill that we had there.
And did you do any sugaring or anything?
Huh?
Did you have any maple sugar bush at all?
No,
up here?
No. The neighbor had. I've seen them making the sugar, but...
Do it yourself?
No. I saw them, you know, they had three kettles, three iron kettles they had, and they had a piece of fat pork on a stick, and if it went ever to boil over, they would stick the fat pork on it, and it would... Stop it from boiling over, yes. Well, when we went over to this place, we had the Hayes family was...
How old were you when you moved here to this farm?
I was just before I was 12. We moved on the 29th of January, and I was going to be 12 on the 8th.
This is what? Lot?
Lot 16.
Concession?
Concession 12.
12.
Yes. 10. No, concession 11.
Concession
11. Was it a better farm? Is that why you moved?
No, Father had sold this farm down where we were. And he had bought another poor farm. He wasn't a farmer. Father wasn't a farmer. He had been a bushman all his life, you know. And he was a dealer. He was a pretty shrewd dealer.
What do you mean dealer? Did he deal in livestock?
Yes, in livestock, mostly.
Would he buy it from?
From the farmers.
And then deal it to a packer or?
We'd keep it for a while, and some of it he would keep till fall and then kill it and sell it in beef, you know. But in his dealings in buying, he was the sharpest. I couldn't stand it, you know. Even if men offered him something which I felt was reasonable, he'd pull him down some, you know. They couldn't get away with him at all.
Was he educated, Mike?
He had never gone to school. Never gone to school.
What would he do? How would he ship anything? Would he ship cattle from here?
No. He was a local dealer. He always had a few dollars. He always had money or somewhere or another. He always had some money. Not a great deal, but some. Of course, you could buy. By the way, when we're talking of dealing, after I was married, the first cattle I sold, I had 7 head of 2.5-year-old cattle in fair shape, sold them for $15 a piece, about 1.5 cents a pound.
Now, what year was that?
That would be in 1907.
Carry on.
Yes,
from
you were here. You were working in the bush with your father after you left school.
Yes. And from then on, I was working winter and summer at home. Until I was 16. When I was 16, he rented this farm to somebody. We decided we'd work in the sawmills. So, in the early spring, like to the present time there, we started walking to Midland and walking to Victoria Harbor to get a job. And we finally had a job in Midland at Playfair's Mill. So at 16, I was working in Playfair's Mill. $1 a day, starting at 7, finishing at 6.
6 days a week.
6 days a week. Yeah. And I was getting $1 a day, and I was allowed to spend a quarter during the week.
For the whole week.
Well, of course, I had to pay my board.
You still had to pay your board out of that dollar a day?
Oh, no. Yes.
What would you pay a week for board?
$3.
So that left you $3 clear, so to speak.
Yes, and I could spend a quarter. And I got tired of the sawmill, and my grandfather, asked me if I wouldn't want to work on the farm. So I went and worked on the farm, 50 cents a day, and board, of course. But I didn't have I didn't have a chance to spend a quarter because there was no stores or nothing around here that you could spend a cent, you know.
This is Grandfather Doe down on the 7th.
On the 7th,
right?
Yeah.
Well, just as a matter of fact, what would you do with your money? There was no bank here.
Oh, give it home. Give it to mother.
Mm-hmm. And nobody had a bank to go to. They would just keep their money.
Oh, there were
whatever cash they had.
Yeah. the money always went home.
But I mean, they talk about putting the money in the mattress, and that's, I guess, what you'd have to do. You wouldn't have a bank to put it in. You wouldn't have
there were banks in Penetang, yes.
Well.
Oh, yes. But there was never enough money to put in the bank.
Farmers, in those days, they didn't pay by check. I mean, it was all cash then, wasn't it? You buy a cow or a horse, you paid in cash for it.
Yes.
Farmers used to keep a considerable amount of money around, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. I know when I was 19, I believe, my father and I cut 580 cords of softwood during the summer months, besides doing our farm work. And we'd get up at 5 o'clock, and we had 2 cows. We'd milk each one cow, and my mother would get the breakfast ready. And by 6 o'clock, we'd be out to the bush cutting wood. We'd come back, dinner at 11, supper at 5, and then work till dark. And we cut 580 cords of wood that summer.
You said you were a sickly child. That doesn't sound very sickly.
I wasn't a child anymore then, although I wasn't too strong either. But father had the power of two men. Oh, he was the toughest man I ever saw. He was half Irish and half French, and he was red in the face, you know, and if he drank, he got redder and straighter, you know. And so anyway, when we cut this 580 cords of wood, we had to haul this to the station here, the switch.
And at Perkinsfield.
At Perkinsfield. And that was a distance of about 4 miles. And we had two sets of sleighs, two teams of horses. And just before winter time there, we made it some racks 16 feet long, because this wood was light. It was all fine cedar, hemlock, things like that. And we had everything ready to start hauling. And on the 11th of November, there was 18 inches of snow fell. So the next morning, we hitched up a team and we went through all our roads. And the next morning, we were at the station when the sun rose with the first loads, about 2.5, 3 quarters of wood. And we run four trips a day. And it was good and dark when we finished. Anyway, he was paid for that wood on the 6th of January. This 580 cords of wood was all piled up on the grounds here.
Was it to be used by the railroad?
Eh?
Was it used by the railroad?
Oh, no. The railroad would take it to Toronto, take it to different places. And we got $1.75 a cord for 75 cords, which was clear pine wood used by the bakers then. And the rest of it, we got $1.05. Cutting it and hauling it here for $1.05. But in those days, those 580 cords of wood probably netted them close to $800, you know. And now, I won't say what happened to this. Right? Father never went to the bank either.
And just go on if you can there.
Well, I think I'll go back to my youth. When we moved here, of course I was only 12, but the Hayes family lived the second neighbor, and there was a boy and a girl. The girl was 5 years older than I was, and the boy was 3 years older. And I started going to their place quite often. The old man had a stallion, and he used to race horses and drink quite a bit. And this girl helped me a great deal in English. I could speak English, I could understand English, but I had very poor English. And she'd tell me, now this is how you should say it. And when I was 16, they started taking me over to dances. And of course, they were all English.
You say over to dances, where?
In Tiny, here in Infinitang. But in most of the dances in Tiny, were the English-speaking people. Lefebvre's Corners, that's the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th, were nearly all English-speaking people then. And so I got to have an opportunity of learning English and getting to know all the English-speaking people and got quite friendly with them. I was very popular with them. And it was a great help to me. And by the way, this girl learned me how to make love, too, you know.
It seems then that the English speakers and the French speakers here got on fairly well, generally.
Oh, yes.
You had to learn English. Did any of the English people learn French?
Well, it's rather sad that the English always have taken the French as an inferior language, inferior race, which is not true. Because I've read the French, the history of France twice in the last 3 years. And France, during the centuries of 14, 15, 16, was the leading country in the world at that time, you know. When in fact, in Europe, anybody that didn't speak French was not educated in those years. And when you think of the two languages, commission, oh, there's thousands of words. Well, you know, England, as I have read, was pretty backwards until the Normans conquered England in the 11th century. And England really spoke French for a number of years then, after the Normans. They brought in and the Normans were practically the same class of people as the English people. They were all men who had came with the Vikings, you know, and settled in Normandy and settled in England. Although they once in France had turned Catholics and had gone perhaps better educated.
So there shouldn't really be any difference between
no.
them.
Right. No.
Right. Well, sir, after you'd gotten back to your boyhood,
yes.
young adulthood, and you were working with your father in the bush,
yes.
Would that take up the whole year, that bush work, between cutting in the summer and hauling in the winter?
Well, this one year it did, but that was an exception year. We did a certain amount of bush work in the summer, but not as steady as that one summer. And
you then, if you weren't working in the bush, you'd be working on the farm.
On the farm.
I think we left off where you're at your grandfather Doe's. Now, did you stay with him for a few years, and then where
oh,
did?
No. I worked for him for the rest of the summer. That was in harvest time, and in the winter, they were making square timber. They were picking up the last pines that were on the Copeland estate, and he had a few. They were making.
Copeland? Where would that be, Copeland Estate?
Near Penetang.
Mm-hmm.
And they hired me as a chore boy. I had about 30 head of cattle, about 30 sheep, 8 horses.
Were you married then?
No.
You were
no, I was just 17 that winter.
17?
Yeah. And I had 3 stoves to keep going. And I was getting 25 cents a day and board. Yeah.
You were going down instead of up. You were getting a dollar, and then you were getting 50, and now you're only getting 25.
Well, to make the chores, that was only 25 cents. And I'd have to get up with the men in the morning and work all day. All these cattle, they had no water at the barn for the cattle and horses. And I'd take them about 60 rods, I suppose, to it. A well in a gully and haul all the water out by.
Was that at the George Copeland farm?
I'm talking about
down
the shores at my grandfather's.
Oh, I see.
To haul all the water with a pail out of a shallow well.
You know, there's a difference between choring and working. I mean, those are two different words. If you're choring, sometimes you only got your board, as I hear it.
Yes.
If you're working, you get paid for it.
In the old days, yes.
In the old days.
It might amount to the same thing for the person doing it.
All right, now you're 17 and you're working for George Copeland.
Yeah. Not for George Copeland, for my grandfather Doe.
All right, grandfather Doe.
Yeah, yes.
Now where do we go from
then,
there?
Then I worked with my father all the years until I got married. And when I got married, I didn't talk about my courting.
Not yet.
No. I was 18, and there were 2 girls from La Fontaine who came here with Clément Maurice, one of Montcalm's uncle. And there were 2 beautiful girls, and I felt pretty hard for one of them. So they invited us to go up there that night. I had a cousin, Elzir O'Mahu, I guess you never met him. We were the same age. So we went up and we got talking to this girl, and she started telling me about her boyfriend, you know, that she had, and she'd been going with him since they were going to school. So I thought, well, that'll be a pretty hard battle. I'm not going to tackle that. So by the way, I met my wife shortly after. And I went with her from that time on. That would be about the end of March until June, 3 years later. Oh, in the meantime, I had other girls, you know, here and there. And of course, it wasn't too handy then. Those horse buggy horse and buggy, you know.
Were you chaperoned? Did people make sure you obeyed all the rules?
Did they
watch you pretty closely?
Yes, the old man used to sit near the box door over there, and he could see through.
And you'd have to leave at a certain time, and...
I know, I was never bothered. Of course, I never stayed too late. 10:30, 11 o'clock, you know.
Was carting always done on a Saturday night or a Sunday night of the week?
Oh, mostly. But occasionally through the week.
Would you meet at church functions or parties or anything as well?
Not very much. My wife was a wonderful singer. She had a wonderful voice. And the Sisters of St. Joseph's had given her training. And they used to have quite a celebration on the 19th of March, St. Joseph, which is the patron saint of the French, you see, in Canada. And, of course, she had quite a big part in that concert. So I always made it a point to go. And father and mother came once, and they thought it was wonderful. They had also Mrs. Tremere. She was an English lady, and she was a wonderful singer, too. And Claude Tremere. I know you've heard, I haven't heard of Claude Tremere.
No.
No. They lived right on the corner of Randolph there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful singer.
And Mike, now you're to the point where you courted your wife 3 years, and when were you married then?
I was married on the 20th of June, 1905.
And did you come back then to the farm here at Perkinsfield?
I bought out my father's farm, and it was a poor farm, and he was selling it to me for $2,800.
This is for 100 acres?
100 acres. Of course, he had paid less than half of that for it. But. So I didn't know. I was been raised there, you know. To me, it was a farm. So anyway, I went to see old A.B. Thompson to lend me money. So old A.B. came one day in a horse and buggy, you know, tied his horse. And there was a big sand hill right where the house was built, and the sand was blowing all over the road. So the old man, he never had much to say, you know, old A.B. Thompson. He looked over, and he went on top of the hill and looked around and came back. He spoke very mildly. He said, "Mike," said, "it doesn't seem much of a farm to me." He said. Well, I started saying that we were getting crops, you know. Well, he said, "I don't think much of the farm," but he says, "I trust you." He says, I lend you the money." So that's how I got started. I guess I paid more than the farm was worth, you know. But anyway, I got my money out of it. I had cleared 4 acres of new land, and all the grain had grown wonderfully in it, and it had to be cut with the scythe. So I hired a man that had married the oldest girl that had been born on that place. And he came and helped me, and he asked me to buy that farm. So I sold it. I got $200 more than I had paid for it. Then I came and bought this place here, again from father.
Mm-hmm.
And
This 100 or 200 acres?
There was 100 acres here, and there was 25 acres of bush back there.
Was it a better farm?
Farm here?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, this was a good farm, but very stony.
I remember you mentioning getting the stones out.
Oh, yes. It cost me more to stone it than what I paid for the farm.
What would you do with your crops when you had gotten them in? Would you?
Oh, well, it was a mixed farming. I kept cattle and pigs, and I got to be a real farmer.
What kind of crops would you grow? Wheat?
I grew wheat, I grew oats and barley and peas and alfalfa.
Where would you sell them, or would you use them yourself?
Oh, I'd use everything on the farm. Yeah.
Well, what would be your cash crop? Would you have a cash crop?
I'd put in about 5 acres of potatoes, yes. Yes, that would be my cash crop. And then the cream. We started selling cream, and the check would come in, you know, every so often.
Mike, let's go back. You're married now. What would be the gift from your father and mother to a newly married couple in those days?
I didn't get much, because father had paid $1,150 for that farm, and he had taken all the wood and he sold it to me for $2,800, but he was supposed to give me $800, you see. So he put on the extra $800. Of course, father couldn't give me much. I knew that. And
but so what would
I had an old team of horses, set of harness, and a purely plow. That's all I had.
That's a single plow.
A single plow. And my wife received furniture for her bedroom.
A bedroom suite.
A bedroom suite. And she got a cow too. And it was a wonderful cow. The old man, Mr. Garage, said to me, he said, "You can have your choice of the cows." He said, "Here's one here, that's a very good cow, but," he says, "she's kind of nervous, and with the only boy is milking," he said, "they're having trouble with her, and she's a good cow." So I chose her.
What was the breed of cattle then, Mike?
Oh, it was, there were a few that had the Herefords by that time, when I got married. Not too many, though. There were all kinds of them. Although some had good bulls around, you know, and they were getting... Oh, I remember when I was a little boy, you know, in the seventh there, and they'd keep their own bulls, you know, and they'd get a big heavy front and nothing behind, and great big head.
Well, Durham cattle were popular then.
Oh, yes. Durham cattle, Nightingales, and my grandfather, though, they had pretty good cattle in Durham.
And what about your horses? I mean, what breed of horses did they have then?
Well, it's quite a mixture of breeds, too. Some had blood horses, and some of these Canadian horses that came from Quebec.
They were called, what's the name of them?
I don't know.
I didn't know too. Maybe I'll remember before this interview is over. But the people here would have to have a good type of a horse, wouldn't they? Because they did a lot of bush work.
Yeah. Around the time that I was about 17 or 18, there were two good Percheron horses came in this district. And we raised wonderful horses with what we had before. And there had been a Percheron horse on the seventh when I was a boy, a gray Percheron. And then there were some Clydesdales that came around too. John Howden from Ellenvale stayed at my place quite a few years. He was traveling a Percheron horse.
Sir, when you got into this second farm and you were farming it and growing the wheat and everything, what would you do for thrashing?
Thrashing? Oh, well, in those days we changed times with the neighbors. Everybody was farming then. There isn't any more of that now. But even the poor land was farmed. And, of course, I always thrashed more than anybody else. So I would pay the difference, you see.
Would they bring in a thrashing machine?
A
portable steam thresher.
Oh, there were regular thrashing machines that were going around, you know, with steam thrashers.
Do you remember the horsepower?
The horse car.
The horsepower for the.
Yes. We used that when I was a child at the seventh. One of those that the horses climbed, you know.
That was operated what, by a team or two teams of horses?
One team.
One team of horses.
Yes. That kind, because it had a platform, you know, to put the horse on. I've heard tell of the other kind, and that the horses went around.
Went around, yes.
That was more than two horses then.
Think four. They used to singly, four pulls.
Yeah.
And what about the straw, Mike? I mean, was there a blower on the machines then?
Not when I first started going to thrashings. You know, it was a carrier. You had to stand at the end of the carrier and keep
shoving the straw up up the carrier. Yeah. And, of course, that took, what, more men on the stack, did it?
Yes. You had to have a couple of men, you know, to give it to the other on the outside. But it wasn't as dusty as the damn blower. floors were terrible.
Mm-hmm. What did you grow?
What did I grow?
What did you grow in the way of grain?
As I said before, I grew wheat and peas and barley and oats. And I remember one time after Page was, oh, that was a few years later, he came to see me and I was in the back field. And I had a field of alfalfa along the fence, you know. And when he came out there, he said to me, he said, "My gosh, you've got a nice field of sweet clover there." "Yeah, you know, it was real." So I laughed and I said, "My God, you don't know your species very well there." He said, "What's the matter?" I said, "This is alfalfa." He said, "You can be." He said, "When you go back, look."
That must have been pretty early, Mike, because I remember when we were on the farm, we grew timothy and red clover. That was, I don't remember my father ever having alfalfa.
Well, that would be...
You must have got started in it quite early.
Oh, yes, yes. I was in alfalfa before I was in county council.
Were you?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, how did you harvest? How did you harvest your grain crop?
Harvested with the binder.
With the binder.
Yes, and hay, of course, in those days was all coiled up in...
In coils and yeah, drawn in loops.
Drawn in, yes.
What about your peas?
Oh, the peas, I made money with peas. In those days, this farm here used to grow the best of peas for soup, you see. You would always boil. And we cleaned them and bagged them up in 100 pound a bag, and they were worth $5 a bag.
Was this seed that was given to you to grow the peas, or was this your own?
My own peas.
Your own peas.
My own peas, yes. And we grew a large pea. Oh, it was not that big.
As big as the end of your thumb almost, yeah.
How did you harvest those peas?
With a pea harvester.
Tell that, explain that to us, will you please?
A pea harvester, you'd take a common mower and you'd install long fingers on it. And at the back, there were wires. The shortest one was next to the peas, and then the one a little longer, the other a little longer, the other a little longer. So that you roll this, and all at once it rolled out, you see, out of the way. And what happened, those peas, during the Depression, I forget what year, but I had a wonderful crop of peas. And no sale. Couldn't sell them. So I kept them over the winter, thinking that always somebody would come along. And I sold them to a man in Alliston the following July for 50 cents a bushel. Beautiful.
There used to be a Mr. Hurst over there that bought peas. Would that be the man?
It might have been Hurst.
W.H. Hurst. But how did you handle the peas then after you cut them? Did you take them to the barn and put them in, or did you custom thrash the peas?
Oh, we had to load them on the wagon.
You put them in the barn?
Yeah.
And then
thrashed them in the field.
Thrashed them in the field?
Thrashed them in the field.
Yeah.
And I remember one year we had thrashed, Stanley Campbell had thrashed for me, and it's a wonderful crop. So it was on a Saturday, and on Sunday my brother Joe was young then, and he came over and he said, "If you want to," he said, I'll clean the peas that are around that place there where you trashed and give you half." Oh, I said, "All right." I thought if he doesn't take much, I'll give the whole thing. And he got 11 bushels.
What did you do with the split peas? Did you separate them, or did you sell them all as they came out of the machine?
Pretty well, yes. Yes. But with these thrashers here, they had kind of rubber...
on their cylinder.
Yes.
That we never stopped them from splitting.
Never had many split peas.
Could we talk about the root harvest now? You grew, you grew potatoes, grew turnips, and you grew mangoes.
And mangoes, yes.
Now, how did you harvest these, so we'll have a record of that?
Everything was done by hand in the harvesting. No, not the potatoes. I had a potato digger.
This is with a team, a single plow and a team of horses.
Yes. But the turnips, Of course, we cut the tops off of the
hole.
Of the hole.
Sir, this is all about the work. Well, when you finished your work, it must have gone on quite a lot. What did you do for entertainment?
Entertainment?
Well, let's finish that part there about the roots first before we get into that.
Yeah. Well,
I think it's worth putting on tape.
I used to grow about 2,000 bushels of turnips each year, and perhaps nearly 1,000 bushel of mangoes. And of course, this was all done by hand.
Right from the beginning to after you planted and they started to come up, then you had to hold them, didn't you, and thin them.
Yes, I am. We had a light job on that. I always waited to put my turnips in about the 20th of June, and I worked my land good. And I made my rows immediately after a rain and put in my turnips. In a few days, you could see the rows. And
did you ridge them?
Yes, oh yes, I ridged them.
And sowed them with a turnip sower?
Turnip sower. And in no time at all, you know, you could do a row. And of course, after I got children old enough, they would get behind us, you know, if we missed, well, they'd take them out. The mangoes were more difficult. And they were, of course, you had to twist them with your hand, you know. And I used to feed my turnips first and keep the mangoes until the cows were in the spring.
And you fed them all to your stock?
Yeah. Now, I did once sell the potato crop had failed completely. And turnips were in great demand. And it was beautiful weather the last week in October. And we used to load two wagon loads and take them to Midland, and the boys would sell them in a day. And we made a lot of money that fall.
Now, let's just finish one thing, and that's the potatoes. I mean, you dug your potatoes with the team of horses.
I'm going to tell you what happened to the potatoes in 1911. 1918. Well, the year of the flu. I had 5 acres of potatoes, and they were a heavy crop, and they had been planted with the plow, you know, and deep. And we were all sick. The wife didn't have the flu, but every one of us had it. And I didn't know whether I would ever get at those turnips and potatoes. But finally, the weather got nice, and I went to Penetang, and I got a bunch of boys, and we got at the potatoes, and we filled one cellar there. And just as we finished, Frank Hayes comes along and said, "You got any potatoes to sell?" I said, "Yes, I have." "How much did you pay?" $1.75 a bag, and that was 90-pound bags then. So we started taking them out the cellar and taking them to they used to load in Perkinsfield. And I don't know just what date that was, but I had taken 175 bags there, and all at once all the whistles and the bells started ringing in Penetang, and Frank Hayes says, "The goddamn war is over," he said. "No more potatoes."
So, you had your potatoes on the siding, and you had to bring them all back home again.
No.
Oh, they were
those sold. That were there were sold.
Sold. Oh.
Yeah. But I would have had about as much more to put on the train, you see.
Just the last question on it, and that is, what kind of potatoes were they, Mike, in those days? Were they just potatoes?
No. They were a certain name, and I can't. They were a white potato.
They were
a white potato, but I can't remember the name. No.
Now, Peter had a question there in entertainment.
Yeah. What did you do for entertainment after your work was over on Saturday night? Or,
well, mind you, for a good many years, I never had much entertainment. My entertainment was my family. I worked from early morning till dark, and I love reading, and whatever entertainment was more or less reading. Until I went into council, I had never entertained very much. Oh, the odd party, you know, between neighbors.
Mm-hmm. This is like what that. I mean, a neighborhood gathering after the thrashing or something like that.
Yes, but everybody were working very hard then, long days.
Well, you see, the reason I'm asking is you mentioned earlier, before we began the interview, about moonshine.
Oh, well, that come on later. When
I see.
After I got Jack came to one of my parties one time. We were drinking moonshine.
Oh, I see. That's later, after the war and after in the 20s.
And when the women didn't go out very much. They never took a drink, you know. They didn't go out very much. Sometimes the men would gather and play cards and have a few drinks. And I always made moonshine for Christmas because we had a big crowd coming on Christmas. And this time when Jack came, I hadn't made any. I bought it from Posey. I bought 2 gallons. And I called Carl Stewart and I said, about this party, and I said, I don't want you to bring any liquor. We've got lots of liquor here. And I want you to bring the same liquor as we do. So they came, and I said, if you drink moonshine, I said, you'll be able to go to your office at 10 o'clock tomorrow and you'll feel fine. Yeah. He told me later it was true, you know.
How was it made?
Huh?
How was it made?
It was made out of sugar and bran. That was all there was to it. Oh, some of them made it with potatoes and different things, but the times that I made it, I only made it for ourselves, you know. Sugar and bran. I think the bran was more or less to keep the temperature. Mm-hmm. I don't see that it did much there.
What color was it, what you made?
The moonshine?
Yeah.
Oh, pure white.
Pure white.
Just like water. Mm-hmm. And
it was distilled.
Oh, yes.
You made a little still.
We had a wonderful machine. We had a copper boiler, and my son-in-law had soldered a flat cover on it, and he'd made a hole about this big and taken one of those old car lights, you know, mm-hmm. and soldered it on there, mm-hmm. and then put a peg of wood of the size of the hole. And the worm would come through this wood, you see. And I had just a stove for this kind of stuff, too. It was a big, great, they used to call them the Great Garland. And it had a draft hole near at the top where you made the fire, you know. So if your stuff went to boil, you just pull this down and let the cool air in, and it would stop it. And then this worm, we put it into our churn, butter churn, and take it out to the bottom where the buttermilk used to come out, you know, and fill the thing with ice and water, and you go ahead and boil.
Were you ever bothered by the authorities?
Oh, yes, I paid a fine once. But it was my boys that had gone at it. And it was bad luck on their... They had bad luck. The youngest fellow had gone to Midland to get his sister, and coming back on Vinton Street there, he nearly struck a little girl coming out of a bus. But he didn't strike her. He pulled off and got in the snow, and I was in Barrie, the county council. And the next day, the police came out, an OPP with Lang from Penetang. And we had the kitchen at the back, and they were boiling in there. And the latch had broken, and we'd put a little peg inside. So they were boiling it, and they'd put the peg in there. And Lang came to the door, and instead of knocking on the house door, he knocked on that kitchen door, and the damn thing opened, and the whole thing was boiling there. I think if Lang had been alone, I'd have been all right, you know, but... The OPP, yeah.
I guess a lot of people made their own up
here.
Oh,
yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. It was made. Right. We had no money to buy liquor then.
Sir, actually, we'd gotten to the point up to around the war. You had been talking about delivering potatoes in 1918. Did the war have any effect up here as far as crops and...
Well, everything sold much higher than usual. Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a chance to get ahead.
Mm-hmm. It's really gave me a great chance to get ahead. I had bought here in 1912, and things were very flat. I remember in 1913 of selling 2 heifers for $52, two heifers 2.5 year old.
That brings up a point. When I talk about the Depression, I mean a depression from 1929 to, say, 1940.
Yeah.
But there were other flat periods or depressed periods. As well. Maybe not as long or as bad.
No. Nothing like that at all.
No.
In 1921, things took a real drop. I went to a sale in La Fontaine, and I bought a beautiful cow for $25, and there were some young cattle there sold. I didn't need them, but I bought them from Joe for Joe, for practically nothing. And there were 7 ewes there I bought for $21.
7 what?
7 ewes, sheep.
Oh, ewes.
Ewes. Yes.
I thought you said mules at first. That's something no one ever talks of. Did anyone have mules here, as opposed to horses?
Mules?
Yes.
No.
No one used them up here.
No mules.
You were speaking, you mentioned Christmas, Mike. What was Christmas like back 75
well,
years ago?
In the first place, the Christmas was a prayer day. There was no celebrations of any kind. New Year's was the celebration day then.
Are you're speaking as a French Canadian, I mean...
Well, yes.
Not as a Roman Catholic.
No. They were all French Canadians,
yeah.
And they all celebrated New Year's.
Yeah, but did you, but not Christmas?
No, Christmas, if they could, they went to midnight mass, or went to mass that day, and that was it.
Did they exchange gifts?
No.
No.
Not that I remember. Yeah.
As a child, did you get anything?
Oh, we'd get an orange on Christmas, or New Year's, perhaps. Yeah. Yes, and a few candies. I remember when I was about 8 years old, I think. I went to Penetang with my father, either before Christmas or New Year's, I don't know. But there was a fly about 8 inches long, and wings about 4 inches wide, you know, and all colors. And, oh, God, I thought I'd like to get that fly. Father bought it for me, 25 cents. And the damn thing, you'd wind it, you know, and she'd run all over the floor. Well, the boys from the 7 would come all the way to my place, and you'd see that fly going on the floor. And then... the fly got battered up anyway, and I was sitting with an older guy than I was in school, and he said, how much do you want for that little machine? I don't remember what I got. He fixed it for a little thing, you know, the little man, you know, and he pulled the string down and picked it. It didn't take much to entertain us then, you know.
Well, when you speak about that, Mike, I always felt that the French people were great entertainers and they loved parties. Now, this takes us back to transportation. How did you get around? I mean, back in around 1900 to attend these parties?
All the horse and buggy.
And buggy, and in the wintertime, what? Sleigh or cutter?
Cutter, yeah. Well, I didn't tell you about the French people that came from Quebec. They had parties. They called them suppers. You know, the neighbors would get together. One put on a supper, and the next one would put on a supper later. And the bottle was on the table, but none of them ever got to drinking too much. And they would sing. But I have never seen any of these old people dancing.
Huh.
No.
Would you have a musical instrument? Would someone have a fiddle or an accordion?
There was no musical instrument. They would sing.
Would the whole family go to these parties, Mike? Children and all?
No. Just the old folks.
Just the old folks.
At New Year's, we used to go to my grandfather.
I had a question there. I was going to ask you about the parties. And I just slipped my memory just for the moment, but I'll get back to it. You something, Peter?
Yes, when you had weddings, you know, sort of special occasions, did they dance or do anything at those?
If they what?
Did they dance or do anything at weddings, say, or at...
There were parties at weddings.
At weddings,
yes. But mostly small parties, nothing elaborate.
Mm-hmm.
When I got married, in La Fontaine, and there was a party at my wife's father. And all we did was, we went for a ride. It was a beautiful June day, and we went around the 17th and came back and spent the afternoon like that. And there were some songs, and They had an organ there, and that girl that played the organ. I had learned a beautiful song for my wedding day, a French song, of course.
What I remember what I wanted to ask you, and that was where were the parties held? Were they held at the homes of people, or did you meet in halls?
No, halls were never thought of then. No, it was always in the home.
Always at the home.
Always in the home, yeah. Well, damn it, you were at my party there in 1910.
Yes, I know that.
In 1940, so you have an idea of how we carried on that night.
But I remember, too, Mike. I mean,
she doesn't want to tell.
Yes, I do. I remember quite well because I drove Carl Stewart's car up to the party that night. Yeah. And Donald McLaren, of course, came along, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I remember it. I've been at several other parties of yours besides. Yeah. And Peter's father has been with me, too, at your place. I remember in our area when I was younger, the family always took the children, and they put the kids to bed, and they'd have a sing song or a dance, and then when they were ready to go home, we would get us up and take us home. I have just two questions, Peter. I'd like to ask Mike, and we're getting very close here, and I know we have a couple little things we want to do, but I'll say I'll ask you one question. What do you contribute your long and useful life to?
Frankly, I was always careful and moderate in my actions. I never went to extremes too much in anything. And I think that the Lord is the giver and taker, and I have faith in that. I have faith that the Lord does what He wants to with every one of us. I was always I was never a roguish man, but I never was real sick either. First time I ever went to the hospital was last fall when I fell. But as you know, I never overdrank too much, and I was always careful eating because I had a poor stomach. And
you've been blessed with really good health.
Huh?
You've been blessed with good health.
Yes, yes.
And you've worked hard.
I've really worked hard. I had a neighbor here, Jack Williams, lived right in front of all those places that I stoned at. Jack said to me one time, he said, "People will no doubt never realize the amount of work you've done." He said, "I know how much you work."
Mm-hmm.
I hired a man one time, and he wasn't too much of a man, but anyway. Oh, years later, we were coming back from town. There were four of us in a car, and he was there, and I was. And they started telling, you know, their prowesses, you know, what they had done. So all at once I said, "Well, I've never done very much." I said, "I wasn't a very strong man." He said, "You," he says, "the devil wouldn't have killed you."
Well, we're just about finished here, and I'd like to say thank you, Mike, but I'd like to also say something else, and that is that I have heard that you were taped, interviewed here a short while ago for a radio station, and perhaps you could tell us about that, and also you might say a word in French about it, too, before we sign off.
Well, in fact, it was my nephew, Romeo, that made the arrangement to have these people come here from Toronto. And I was very glad because there's no doubt. The unfortunate part of it was that it wasn't well known enough in this district.
What radio station was it on, sir?
CJBC. And oui, messieurs, j'ai eu le privilège et le plaisir d'être interviewé par les membres de CJBC. Trois hommes, dont je ne me souviens pas des noms, mais trois hommes sont venus et m'ont interviewé pour 2 heures. Et ils m'ont dit qu'ils seraient obligés de couper des parties parce qu'il fallait que ça paraisse seulement pendant 3 quarts d'heure de temps. Et vous, messieurs, Je vous remercie beaucoup. Monsieur Jack. Monsieur.
Pierre.
What's the name?
Pierre.
Peter?